This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 5th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 313 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Dana Arnold, the design-minded authority on architecture, who's now turning a studious eye to the art world and asking, can't it be a bit more fun?
A little later on, also, we'll be flexing our culinary muscles with a world-class competitor on the cookery scene, a 6-times world pizza champion, no less. Make of that what you will, but we will be making pizza with Bruno Di Fabio, the New York pizza guru, who's now giving London a spin.
And we'll meet Will Gregory, better known as one half of chart-conquering synth outfit Goldfrapp. Ahead of his new show at London's Barbican this week, he'll be telling us why vintage Moog keyboards are still a sound we should get excited about.
That's all coming up, plus Tom Edwards will be gazing into the mists of next week's current affairs landscape with the news look ahead. And we'll have some good music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. The soundtrack to this show should be Too Darn Hot, sung by Ella Fitzgerald.
It's blooming warm
in
here,
isn't it? Studio One, the normally Siberian Studio One. What a week it's been, Andrew. It's been the hottest temperature ever in Wimbledon history. It's been recorded in Wimbledon.
We had to have emergency rosé wines.
And I think all of the corner shops in the Marylebone vicinity have done a roaring trade, mostly out of Tom Edwards. We can talk about this in a minute when he comes into the studio. Mostly because of Tom Edwards and his... well, all-conquering hunger for Cornetto Classico.
Yeah, right? he loves an ice cream. He's often heard saying, do you think it's time for an ice cream?
Yeah, about 9:30 in the morning.
Yes.
Until about 6:30 at night. It's been good. Are you the kind of person that loves to... do you like to be the temperature of how what it is outside? Or would you like to button yourself up, turn the aircon on and close the windows?
I'm not a fan of aircon, but we have a kind of situation in our office where we're slightly on the shadier side, so I'm always saying, turn it off. On the other side where they're cooking, dying. They're like, just a little bit, please, sir.
Exactly. Please can I have a bit of puff. Just a bit of puff.
No, I like a breeze, but I like to be, I'd rather be warm and have an open window.
Yeah, me too. I like that. That goes for, like in a hotel, is that what you do? Do you open the windows, turn off the aircon? You normally get into a hotel room, it's like 18 degrees.
I always turn it off.
Okay, good. I don't know why.
I like.
We've don't never covered this
hot,
subject together.
But I also don't like the rattling noise it makes either. And you wake up and you think you're in a fridge.
I like a ceiling fan.
Okay, we've done temperatures.
What about a ceiling fan?
Oh,
it's a bit apocalypse now, but I don't like it.
No, it's quite nice. It's quite nice, unless you think it's going to fall off.
Talking of which, shall we drag Tom Edwards from his news cupboard?
Who's got a waggy tail?
Who's got a winning grin?
Who can sniff out the spookiest news?
Who knows when to bark and bite?
Who's got the nicest coat?
Who can round up some global tales?
Who can scent a breaking story?
And who likes his tummy tickled?
Oh yes, it's that lovable news hound.
It's Tom Edwards.
Come home, Daddy.
Okay.
Oh, yes. What have you got for us, Tommy?
Hard to start anywhere else today, isn't it, than the referendum, of course, which is taking place as we sit here in Greece. Will the Greeks vote to stick and suffer the consequences of further austerity? Or will it be, you know, nine to Europe? Hard to say. But it's a momentous day.
And even then, it's not clear what's going to happen
tomorrow. Well, absolutely.
Tomorrow.
Exactly. I mean, even if they stick around, we could only be postponing what some now perceive to be inevitable, which would be, you know, to the Grexit, an ugly portmanteau, but there we are. That's what it's known as. But I think it's a pretty extraordinary day in a series of extraordinary days.
Do you think the only countries that may leave the European Union are ones that have sort of two consonants at the front of their... like Grexit, because Jurexit doesn't work, doesn't
no,
it? Germany
Jurexit.
Can't leave. Frexit, they could leave.
Frexit,
Itexit,
that
doesn't work, so they're
no,
fine.
Sounds like Spexit. A Mexican god.
Spexit,
I like.
Spexit, I kind of like. Am I, no. That's not serious enough, is it, for this section of the
show?
Good. Oh, no, it is. It's fine.
Exactly. No, that may be, to be honest, that would be as good a reason as any.
That would be as good, good a reason.
The ramifications. However, if you are of a slightly more serious bent, if you're worried about this, you can listen to the bulletin with UBS this week in just a few short hours from now, with lots of insight and analysis on the background and what the future could hold.
How long are we going to get the... How soon does it take to get the votes in, do you reckon?
Oh, Chris? I don't know things like that, Rob.
Well, no, I'm just. I I'm think, not, well, no, I'm not being funny here.
We'll,
but
know,
there
we'll,
a lot
know,
of,
we'll know tomorrow.
Yeah, we'll know
sure.
tomorrow. Morning.
It's a very. This is none more spread out a nation, is it, than Greece? Really, of all the islands, all the places. It's
that's
quite tough to kind of must be. I've always thought it must be quite a tough place to count the votes. Andrew, what are you doing?
I've got my cable from my headphones caught under my wheel.
just checking.
This is as complicated as the issue in Greece. I think.
I thought you were miming some of the the dog voices from Tom's intro.
I'd got the
theme
lead
tune.
I'd got the lead caught around somewhere like down in Corfu. I think it was.
Is that what you call it?
Well, let's move on, shall we? And another thing which preoccupies people throughout Europe, it's not just the euro or health otherwise, it's fish, of course, and a lot of people talk about overfishing. Mm. It's quite interesting. Today was the day that Europe would have run out of fish if it only fished its own waters and didn't import fish from elsewhere.
Really?
That's it, the last fish gone. All the
that's
oceans
terrible,
would
isn't it?
Be empty.
Since when? If we hadn't imported when? Since
I don't know. I'm slightly confused about this model specifically, but that's when it would have run out.
It would run out, that fish.
All the fish. But it's just a good lesson. Only eat sustainable fish. I'm getting a bit right on the weekly this week.
Or import them from other places and leave your own alone.
Yeah, massive carbon footprint.
So meanwhile, somewhere yeah. else in the world, they've run out of fish, but Europe's fine.
No, but it's sustainable fishing. I'm making a line caught, that sort of thing. I know it's a slightly tangential
I think you've been a bit shellfish there about that
story. Oh, dear. Oh, then I can make my Just for the Halibut joke again, which I always make every time there's...
Okay,
let's move on, shall we?
Yes.
A couple of interesting events to look out for this week, which I think Monocle readers and listeners will find intriguing. One of my favourite events, I've not attended it, but I've heard tell of the legend, is the famous Tokyo Stationery Fair, which is on Wednesday. And no one knows more about stationery than the Japanese. That's
you have to you stand can't... still the whole week, apparently.
Ha-ha! Spelled with an A. A for Andrew Tuck.
Wow.
So pleased with that. But it's stationery and office products, Andrew.
Okay.
Got any
okay.
office product puns?
No.
He's thinking of one.
No, I haven't.
No, but that is a legitimately interesting thing. If you're intrigued by developments within the world of stationery, they're really pushing the envelope this year.
They're part of your staple diet.
He made it. That's it.
Shall we just send Tom Reynolds to it?
That would be a good idea.
He's quite good on the stationery.
He's good on the stationery. Now, there's another thing happening on Friday, which is quite exciting. And that's obviously we've been counting down to the Monocle's verdict on not fine dining, just great restaurants. And I think I'm right in saying that on Friday the 10th, we will learn the winners in the menu with Monocle. And this has been quite
I'm excited about this. It's quite exciting.
Yeah.
We're going to name Monocle's 50 best restaurants in the world. It's just like when we do the quality of life survey, the soft power survey. We've garnered opinion. We've been to places. We've looked at the places we've loved over the past 8 years. But the reason we've done it is we're kind of a bit fed up of all of these kind of very similar restaurants winning again and again. Everyone loves a bit of foam, it seems. Everyone loves a bit of dry ice cream. Fine. But actually, where do you go back to again and again? What's the neighbourhood restaurant that wins you over? Where's the place that's kind of kept the same ambience for years? Who's got, you know, the best maitre d'? And all of these places have kind of come charging up our list. I've seen many of the top group. We haven't seen the winner yet. But I think it's a really just good surprise. And it's a good antidote to a kind of rather one-sided conversation at the moment about what makes a good restaurant.
And absolutely, and you think about fine dining, it's a lot of fun, but it can be very expensive. You know, these places where it takes, 2 years to get in and you spend €800 to dine there. As you say, Andrew, you're not going to be popping in there every now and again and being friends with the maitre d' somewhere like that. It's a different experience.
And I think it's also, you know, we have chosen places which are classic, which are old school, which have got, nice kind of like white tablecloths. But we've also chosen places which actually are little more than a place on the beach that just does amazing food, but have done it for generations and generations. So there's some real surprises.
Some real gems.
Taco truck in Los Angeles made it into the final list. I think I was out of the office when this was decided.
Oh. I think you made that sound like it was your own taco truck.
Yeah.
Is that what you've been doing?
Yeah, that's what I've been doing. That's what I do every Sunday.
I see.
Roberto's, yeah.
Roberto's. That's quite good. Yeah. I'd eat there. Give it a try.
Yeah, it's good.
Good.
Corn.
That's pretty much all I've got. All I've got time for.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Tom. As ever, a privilege to have you with us.
From Istanbul.
From Hong Kong.
This is Monocle 24.
Tokiosta. Tämä on Monocle 24.
こちらは Monocle 24です。
Questa è Monocle 24.
To Paris. To Munich.
From London.
To Berlin.
To Istanbul.
To Frankfurt.
To Zurich.
To Madrid.
To Singapore.
To Barcelona.
To Toronto.
To Helsinki.
To New York.
To Lisbon.
To Tokyo.
Broadcasting around the world, around the clock.
Monocle 24.
From Midori House in London. You're tuned to Monocle 24.
A stroll through the museum or gallery is defined not only by the works on show, but by the context we put them in. On those tiny cards next to the big paintings, which you may or may not read, to put it simply. Though they contain the odd interesting factual nugget, they also contain a lot of jargon. If you don't know what Cubism or the Renaissance were, why would you be interested to know you're looking at a Cubist or Renaissance work of art?
Dana Arnold is an authority on both art and architecture. She's currently Professor of Architectural History and Theory at Middlesex University, and is former editor of the Art History Journal. Recently, she's been looking at the narratives of art and asking whether there's more, or in some cases less, to be said about them. Dana's book, A Short Book About Art, aims to explain this giant topic in a simple new set of terms, categories that range from devotion to power and sex. And she joins us now to tell us all about it. Thank you for coming to see us. And it's a rather wonderful small book, because it kind of reintroduces you to the world of art, and I think will be appealing to people who know nothing almost and people who know quite a lot. Is your role in this book to be a bit of a curator, looking afresh at the world of art and finding new threads through it?
Yes, absolutely, it is. I mean, one of the aims is exactly as you say, to create a dialogue between people who might be new to art, first time in the gallery, and they go home and think, oh, I want to know a bit more about that. But also to people who are really quite familiar with it, and to try and just present it in a different kind of way. And so the book really aims to have a conversation with both sets of readers, if you like. For me to take you or another round the gallery and tell you all about it. Yeah.
And books have been written in the past which sort of aim to get rid of the jargon, as we've said in our preface to this interview, Dana, to get rid of the art jargon and all the tricksy kind of composition of the sentences and the technical wording of it. And your book actually is a rare thing, and it genuinely succeeds in doing this. But I do find that people are scared of their own interpretation, because you offer the history behind when things were painted, when things were made, rather than necessarily interpreting them, right?
I think sometimes, yes, there is that feeling of being slightly intimidated, or if to understand something you have to work through 15 subclauses, you know, that there's sort of something more there than there actually is. But if you unravel all of that, it's not that the book is simple, it's just things are presented in a very straightforward and readable way. It's a conversation. I want it to be a conversation between me and the reader.
No, I'm not saying why I jumped to this chapter first, but the chapter on sex, actually, it's a bit of a cheat. It's not really about sex, is it? It's about depictions, really, of women. It's about gender more than anything else, but maybe the word sex is more likely to drag you to that chapter first. And what's fascinating is you run from Titian all the way through to Sarah Lucas. And part of it is just almost the way that the knee is used throughout art history, the movement of the knee slowly downwards, and as the nude begins to face us in pictures, tells the story of women's power changing and how we see women changing. Could you just tell us a little bit why you chose that kind of arc?
Well, what I was interested in is, first of all, you know, as you say, everyone's going to leap to the chapter on sex soon.
Sorry. Okay.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
I was only interested in the one on power, craft.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a route to self-knowledge, this book. This is really what it's all about. But there, you know, as you say, initially it's kind of, it must be about the nude. And so I talk about the difference between naked and nude and that sort of thing, and trace through ideas about the representation of women as sex objects. So you get images of that, you know, Venus of Urbino, you know, Titian's views of Venus, you know, that kind of thing. But then What I wanted to do was think about how women artists have responded to that. How have they, you know, reinterpreted those kinds of representations of women? And so then you get to Sarah Lucas or Carolee Sheeman. They're actually doing something which parodies that and makes a comment on it and perhaps makes us think about things in a different way. And in fact, it picks up on your point about the chapter on power, because it's women artists kind of empowering themselves as women artists and also empowering women by showing that it's a different way of representing female sex and sexuality.
And I'm so glad you mentioned quite at length, actually, Beth Moiseau and the girl lying on the reclining on the divan, because it's one of the few, I suppose it's in the Impressionists era, isn't it?
Yes,
it's a work
yes.
like that. One of the few paintings that is genuinely sexy and is painted by a woman and has that direct gaze that a man would kind of very rarely make a painting like that. And that's one of the interesting sort of things about power. And it's only when you realise, perhaps, that you look at the name, and then you realise, even if it's a foreign one, that it's a French name, and you don't need to translate that for it to be a woman. But the sort of incredible power of that. Is that one of the things you wanted to do, to actually also have, to encourage people to foster their visceral responses to works of art and to trust their responses to works of art?
Yes, that's exactly it, absolutely. It is just to, if you like, empower the viewer.
Mm.
That, you know, we're allowed to go into a gallery and think, I like that, I don't like it. And then the categories in the book or the themes in the book perhaps enable you, or the viewer, to think about, why do I like it? How do I respond to it? What does this say to me? How might I think about this artwork in a number of different ways?
And that's where the complexities of language come in, isn't it? It's when the tricksiness comes in. It's when people try to, well, they feel they have to be extra artful somehow in the way that they describe something rather than be very plain. And, you know, you dance to songs, but there's obviously some people, we still don't know quite how to show that we appreciate a work of art rather than writing some very, very tricksy words about it.
Yes, I think so. Whereas, you know, I try and start off by saying, this is actually a physical object. It's made of stone or paint or pigment or glass or whatever it might be. So it has a physicality, and we need, or it's very helpful, I think, to respond to that and realise that it's artifice. And then beyond that, what we bring to it as a viewer, what it might mean in different cultural contexts. And throughout the book, I refer to the example. So although something might be discussed in a chapter on mind, for instance, I might refer back to it when I'm talking about devotion, or, you know, in another chapter, to show that there are different ways of looking at things.
And Dana, do you hope that it kind of challenges people's tastes a bit as well? As you said, you know, for someone like me who likes art, enjoys going, but maybe doesn't have all of the, you know, the skills that someone like yourself has to look at the history of art, what I found interesting was, you know, that whether, for example, in that same chapter on Sarah Lucas, you may think you're a fan only of contemporary art, you suddenly see the links going back centuries, and you realise that one really can't exist without the other. And also, if you go back all the way to the likes of Manet, you realise, actually, I should be looking at more contemporary things because there is an echo there. Are you trying to stretch people's tastes and challenge them a little bit as well?
Yes, I am. And not just in the kind of the broad sweep of time, but also across geographies and cultures. That I do try and make connections between artworks that come from Europe, Asia, Africa, just to show that there are different ways of thinking about things and making connections. The timeline is definitely one thing. I mean, I think that, you know, well, the book opens with that caveman to Picasso type view, which I think is there. And it's a deliberate sort of, if you like, provocation to say, this is how we like to think of the history of art. It starts with cavemen, it finishes with Picasso, and it's all about progress. Whereas what I'm trying to say is, well, we can actually make connections backwards and forwards and sideways and across different times and geographies to think about things in, you know, new and I think sometimes surprising ways too.
I'm always interested to see what artists think about what's said about their work, actually, because artists talk often in very plain language about the things, and their motivations for making a particular piece are often very simple, because they like the colour or because they love the shape or because they think it's genuinely sexy or something. I don't wonder what you thought of that, and whether in your experience that it's art writers that have invented this tricky language about artists deal, well, in the art in which they make, and that is their language. But when they have to talk about it, it's more simple than we might imagine, and it's refreshingly so.
Well, in fact, there is a sort of third person in the dialogue, if you like, because it's a conversation between me and the reader or the person who's looking at the artwork.
Yeah.
But throughout the book, I've tried to include artists' voices with quotations from artists. So each chapter begins with a quotation that sets it up, and the text is peppered with them as the artists join the dialogue. And what I don't do is tell the reader what the artist is saying or what he or she means by what they're saying. Their voice
just
is just
there. Yeah, because someone like, sorry, Andrew, someone like Picasso is so, has got such a visceral voice, like his work. He can't, it's almost like you can tell from the quotes that you've put in your book, he can't wait to tell you why he made something, because it still excites him even in the telling of it.
Absolutely.
And that's something that really comes off the page.
Yes.
Tell me, it's a Tate book. Were they keen for you to include a number of Tate artworks in the book, or were you kind of left to your own devices?
I was left to my own devices. And they were very happy with, you know, me to write something that actually worked. I think that was the priority.
But for Tate, it's interesting, because I guess when we're talking about that kind of the idea of art becoming, you know, in a really positive way, a mainstream interest. They've been at the heart of that with Tate Modern, especially in recent years. When you go there at the weekend, you just see people are desperate to look at art. Are these the glasses, in a way, that you can give to those people who, as you say, are coming fresh to it?
Yes, I think so. But I think also for people who perhaps read a number of surveys, you know, quite sort of au fait with, you know, art history and, you know, art criticism, I think there's something fresh for them too. You know, I don't want to exclude one category, because I think there are ways of writing things that are accessible but are still challenging to those who are more familiar with, you know, histories and different kinds of arguments.
And I just wondered, you're interesting on the idea of art that isn't from the West, and isn't, you know, especially art that's old that isn't from the West. And I wonder whether you can, whether it is possible to read a Picasso or something like it. Is possible to read something that's Aboriginal, for example, which is, there's Aboriginal art shows on in London, so it's kind of vaguely topical. We sort of need a bit more historical apparatus to get into the head, maybe, of the Aboriginal artists from the 18th century, don't we? Or can we read those two things just the same?
I think we can. I mean, you know, so you're never going to be able to ask Mr. and Mrs. Caveman what those pictures in Lascaux mean. You can, you know, sort of see them in different ways and use them as ways of understanding how we look at art, the kind of narratives that we need to somehow make sense of it, or we feel we need to make sense of it. But if we ask different questions, it's actually fine.
And maybe, and I wonder whether you're interested, I mean, you address it in the book, and this is one that it starts off with, this is why works of art were made. That's quite an important one, isn't it? To know, to appreciating it, or to kind of getting into the head of the artist a bit, is kind of whether they were commissioned for it, whether they just dreamt it up at 3 o'clock in the morning in some kind of fugue, you know, or there's the reason why stuff is made is kind of important, isn't it?
It is important, but if we don't have the answer to that, then I think we just ask different questions. You know, if we have, you know, the artist speaking about the work, or in the case of the Leonardo that I discuss, you know, we've got the contract, so we can see in quite a lot of detail what that's about. And even that's surprising, because we now think of Leonardo as a genius who, you know, we'd just be so happy for him to do anything, whereas there was this contract saying, you will paint this, you will do it this way, you will do it that way, and you'll produce it. So it puts him in a very different light, I think.
Yeah, the mercantile and the mercenary is at work in every genius, right? With a lot of historical gloss on it.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating stuff. Well, Dana, thank you so much for coming in. Congratulations on the book, which is a short book about art. The author is Dana Arnold. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's have a song, Andrew, shall we?
Yes, please.
We've just been discussing new ways to look at art, so now let's hear the quite blissful Now You See Everything from Olympia, Washington folky Stephen Steinbrink. That was Now You See Everything from last year's gorgeous Arranged Waves album by Stephen Steinbrink. You can catch Stephen on tour across Europe later this summer. We're heading into the Monocle kitchen next to make pizza with Bruno Di Fabio.
The city of Porto is emerging from the shadows, boasting a newfound confidence and an iconic visual identity to match. We meet the city's mayor, who knows a thing or two about winning an urban battle.
I'm like a Swedish grandfather knitting socks, you know, and that's the city I'm trying to build. And maybe there will be a time in the future when we will need heavy infrastructures. But at the moment, that's We are concentrating on the more Schumpeterian approach to the city, on small is beautiful and the small things we can do.
Porto Revival, now playing in the film section of Monocle.com.
Now, it might be an understatement to say that Andrew and I were not aware of the World Pizza Championships before this weekend, and this highly subjective competition is hotly debated in culinary circles, the kind of culinary circles that New York pizza guru Bruno De Fabio moves in. He's won medals in fields ranging from taste to speed at the annual event commonly held in Salso Maggiore Terme near Parma in Italy.
Now, Bruno is bringing his take on New York pizza to London with the opening of NY Fold on Charing Cross Road, named after the folding technique needed to handle a well-topped slice of one of New York's signature dishes. A little earlier, Rob and I ventured just down the corridor and into the Monocle kitchen to meet Bruno and learn what it takes to make a world-beating slice.
You know, we all know that historically the birthplace of pizza is in Naples, but yeah. I really like to think that the birthplace of pizza is New York City post-World War II. That's where it really blew up and spread like wildfire, okay? So for me, New York pizza is a pizza that's more bread-like in consistency. So the crust definitely has more flavor, it's more substantial, and it's a golden finish. Unlike the Neapolitan, and listen, I don't hate Neapolitan, and that's the truth. So I do master that style as well.
The best pizza I've ever had in the world is in Naples, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the king. I've worked in Trianon. I've worked at Da Michele in Naples, in Spacca Napoli, and it's a great style.
Yeah.
But you know what? London is an underserved market in pizza generally, but there's no New York pizza here. There's no New Yorkers. There's no brash New Yorkers here to make you guys a proper pizza.
I hope you're not getting a return ticket. Back to New York in that case,
you know what? I tell you what, I have a return ticket, but I'm, you know, we're struggling training guys. So you know what? As of right now, I'm going to be touching every single pizza that comes out of that oven at New York Fold.
So, Bruno, we should explain. You're here because you are opening an outpost here in London.
That's
a big restaurant on Charing Cross Road.
That's
just tell us a little bit about the concept.
Well, I'll tell you what. I am jazzed to be in central London. I cannot believe the amount of people that are walking around. I mean, honestly, it's busier than 42nd Street in New York City. I'm really, really proud. I'm really excited to share what I know, and you know, I've been making New York pizza for over 30 years and 22 years professionally for myself. So you know, I can't wait to bring it, and I you know, there's going to be a little bit of an educational component to it, but you know, I hope you guys are ready to be bored to tears, because I'm gonna bring the science too. I'm gonna give you a little bit of a background on ingredients and why they're important to me and why they're important in New York style pizza making.
Now you've very kindly brought in all the ingredients we need to actually make a pizza here at Midori House headquarters of Monocle. Explain to us how this is going to happen and the process.
All right, well, today what we're going to do is we're going to make a pizza, a New York style pizza. And what's a New York style pizza? It's a medium bodied crust. So it's a crust that's more substantial. But those of you that are like so worried about diet and all of that, let me tell you something that's going to blow your mind. Our pizza goes under three different fermentation stages, okay? And during fermentation, it gives during a longer fermentation, it allows the yeast to break down complex starches in the flour. So think about it. That's something that your stomach would have to do if you were eating a super fresh dough. So how many times have you eaten a pizza where you feel like you've just, you know, you're trying to digest a lead ball, right? Our pizzas, because of our fermentation process, are very, very light, very airy, but very digestible. And you know what? I don't think chefs in the UK talk about digestion enough, but this pizza that I bring here, you're just going to want to eat more and more because it's very, very light, airy, and digestible. Are you guys ready?
Yeah, and what about the water, Bruno? Because people say the New York pizza is so good because the water, I guess.
Well, the water, honestly, is complete bullshit, okay?
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. What it is, honestly,
I thought bullshit was just a hidden ingredient. I didn't know that.
Well, the reason why I call bullshit on that is because, all right, listen, New York City water's from the Adirondack Mountains. It is very, very good water. When I dine out in New York City, I never get bottled water. I always ask for tap water. But what the thing is, like they say, you can't get good pizza outside of New York. What happened is generations after generations of pizza makers in New York, what they did as they spread out around the world, they took that New York style recipe and they didn't modify it. They didn't modify it in Florida and California and in Arizona, where the humidity is out of control, where the water has chlorine in it. So they didn't know how to deal with these types of things. So obviously think about it. In Florida, your temperature of your flour is probably 100 degrees in a kitchen compared to New York where it might be 70 degrees. So think about it. Time and temperature really, really can modify the way your raw ingredients perform in a certain style. So what you have to do is away from New York, and I found it here. It's been a challenge because the ingredients are different here than I found in New York. So you do have to modify your technique a little bit. But, you know, you modify your technique. You can chill your water. If it's chlorinated, chlorine dissipates after 24 hours. Not a lot of people know that. So you could fill a container. In 24 hours, your chlorine dissipates. If it's hard water, you can adjust the saline salt content. So there's ways of battling it. So, yeah, I call BS when it says it's all about the water.
All right.
So okay, we should start you. You've got the flour in front of
let's
you.
Let's do it, guys.
And you've
you
got
ready?
Pots with like six ingredients all ready to go. And I should say that Bruno is kind of dusted himself with a light amount of flour as well. From
I'm wearing a black chef coat. I think that was the wrong idea here.
Yeah, I like it though. We can show that your commitment to the cause. This is all going straight in the wash.
Well, guys, what I want to do is I want to talk to you a little bit about toppings too. So New York style is a more substantial style. So you could see a variety of different toppings on the pizza. But what I did was, you know, to have some reverence to where we are, I'm also a bit of a wild food forager. And I made a pesto today that was foraged from wild edibles growing invasively here in London, actually in Richmond. So I did go on a little bit of a forage mission.
Cannabis pizza, okay.
Yeah. So what we have in here is what we have in here is we have a little bit of wild arugula, a little bit of basil, because I had to cheat a little bit, but you have wild chickweed and you have garlic mustard plant. Right. Which grows here invasively. So, you know, right under your feet, you have things, you know. Let's open our eyes a little bit, right, and just be closer to the earth and see what we have. And that's what I wanted to do here, pay a little bit of reverence.
So you put down the dough here on the counter, nice amount of flour all around.
Exactly. So New York style is all about the New York slap, and that's like not just slapping the guy in the face, right? So we get a little bit of a slap here, right? This dough kind of like opens up almost by itself. So today, what we're going to do is, we don't have a pizza stone here, but what we're going to do is we're going to cook on steel. And steel is a very, very in surface to cook your pizza on. A lot of people talk about cooking their surface on a stone, but steel is actually a very good surface too.
This is about conductivity. Is this
exactly?
It doesn't. But once it comes off the slab, it doesn't make any difference.
Make any difference at all. But you're right; it does conduct the heat quite evenly. So
quite
it gives
a scientific question. Yeah, you're surprised.
Yeah, but within 2 seconds,
you stole his thunder. Are you kidding?
We should just point out in 2 seconds the dough ball went to actually the whole base of the pizza already. Yeah.
Well, I've been doing it for quite a while.
I know, it's quite quick though.
It's thin.
But here's a bit of science. Why doesn't it tear? Why is it so kind of consistent?
Oh boy, are you ready to get bored out of your mind? I'm going to get geeky on you right now, okay? So this is high gluten flour, right? So everybody's more aware of gluten and the gluten strands right now because there's a lot of celiacs out there that are gluten intolerant. So this is a high gluten flour. So the two strands of gluten here are gliadin and glutenin, and they get twisted, and they're what holds the dough together. It forms a net, and it traps the carbon dioxide that is a byproduct of the yeast, and that's what gives growth to the pizza dough. So that's why the dough puffs out,
well,
right?
It looks great. And then the first topping I can see you're lining up.
So what we have here is we have a whole milk mozzarella. We're not doing a traditional tomato sauce on here. Whole milk mozzarella. It's got a 3% butter fat. It's harvested daily from cows, and it's got a 5-star rating from the Milk and Dairy Board. So this is a very high quality cheese.
And what in terms of the cheese, does it matter if you put buffalo on there or if you put cow?
I'm glad you asked that. So I prefer New York style, we prefer to use an aged mozzarella.
Right.
Okay. Aged mozzarella performs a lot better because we're baking this for about 10 or 12 minutes. You'll use a fior di latte or a buffalo mozzarella in Neapolitan or wood fired style because it melts quickly. Mm-hmm. And but when you overcook it, it bleeds too much of the
milk. So we've got a long out. We're going in the oven for longer.
Yeah,
than,
we're
going to
be
fire.
In the oven probably for 10 minutes.
Okay.
All right, so we brought a meatball that, again, you know, we're local and organic, sustainable, when possible, obviously.
Strangled this pig somewhere in Chiswick.
In Chiswick. That's awesome. We can't wait. I'm going to tell that one later. But, you know, obviously, you know, the best olive oil, I think, comes from, like, Emilia-Romagna in Italy. So, yeah. You know, local, an organic when possible. That's what I believe.
Sorry, is this onion going on now?
Yeah, so that's caramelized onion. That's a local onion, right? I cheat a little bit. I like to use a little bit of agave nectar in here. It helps to give it a rich color.
Sweetness.
And yeah, and I'll let it cook for a while. I'll add a little bit of water so it doesn't quite stick. I like to play around with sweet and savory flavors, so you'll see that in a lot of my pizza. So we're ready to go in the oven, guys. What we're going to do is we're going to finish this with the pesto. I'm big into finish ingredients, right?
Nice.
We're going to cook this. It's going to take about 10 minutes, as we said. So we should probably put this in the oven right now, huh?
Well, it looks fantastic. It looks good in its raw state, doesn't it, Andrew? You feeling hungry?
I'm very, very hungry. Just looking fat.
I know.
I like pesto.
You like the pesto as well? I kind of like that. I like the fact that it's been foraged from between the cracks in the London pavement as well.
Unbelievable.
It's good, right? I think we need what is in, I don't know what it is in radio terms, but in television terms it would be called a soft dissolve.
Yes.
We will come back in a couple of minutes when that pizza is ready.
Very cool.
And we will be morphed, Andrew, into demanding New York pizza experts.
Yes.
Right?
Drooling. Oh, this looks amazing.
I'm pretty happy with it.
Yeah, that is incredible.
It looks pretty good.
What are we naming this pizza? We didn't.
Oh, this is one. Cool. This is one that makes it on the menu at the new store. This is called Starry Hope.
Starry Hope.
Starry Hope. Yeah. So we finish with a little bit of our freshly foraged pesto sauce.
So it's got a really nice golden color. There's still a dusting of flour you can see around on the crust.
For sure.
It looks really. Well, it's a bit delicious.
It's got a look of classiness about it, isn't it? It's a pale palate.
And we'll finish with a little bit of extra virgin olive oil from Emilia Romagna.
Doesn't look good.
All right, just a little bit more fiddling time here. Oh, that's nice. Oh, it sounds good, guys. I think we're in for a treat. What I look for in a proper New York slice is that in Italian they call it the cornicione, but this end crust here, you see how it has gaping holes in it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's from the carbon dioxide gas being trapped in there for such a long time. So this pizza looks giant, but you can see it's very airy, it's crispy, and you know, again, super digestible and still a little hot. So
now, Bruno, we should quickly quiz you. You are the world champion.
That's
now,
right.
And a global world champion.
That's
at
right.
That.
So that's right. I'm a six-time world pizza champion.
Sorry, six times.
That's not right. Come on, let's get it right.
Well, he came with all his medals.
That's
Andrew.
Right.
Come on.
That's right. All my trophies.
And what do you have to do to be a world champ then?
Well, there really is something called the World Pizza Championships. It's very well attended by many, many different countries. I've won it on the big stage, miraculously, for me. Many times, but I've won it in the city of Naples. I've won it in Paris at Euro Disney. And we're talking against, you know, over 200 competitors, you know, and I'm a repeat multi-time world champion. I've won it in Brussels. I've won it in New York. And I've won it in Las Vegas.
And are they judging you on the quality of the ingredients, the speed?
So I am a multi-time champion on taste. Again, you know what's so interesting, when I go to a competition, I'll go maybe 4 or 5 days before, and I'll try to become inspired by the local markets, like the Borough Market or something like that. And you know, I'll gain inspiration with my toppings and my ingredients wherever it may be. If it's in, you know, northern Italy, southern Italy, in France, that's what I do. And you know, hopefully, well, it has shined through a lot, you know, where, you know, you have international judges, and thank God, I think I've really been judged fairly throughout my career.
Should we just pick up a slice?
Yeah,
and Bruno, you can judge us on how well we can do the
fold. Oh, come on now. You got it. Let's do it.
Is this it?
Yeah. He's got the New York fold right there.
Okay.
Perfect.
Buon appetito, guys.
Brilliant.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're amazing.
Mm. That was really good. Let's talk
about it.
Very nice. Well, Bruno, thank you very much for coming to see us. Good luck with the restaurant.
I appreciate you having me.
If it's as good as this, I think you're going
to
do very well.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, here's to New York Fold. Nice one, Bruno.
Guys,
thank you.
It was an honor. Thank you very much.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the program delivers definitive insights into the people, places, and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
You're listening to the talents of Will Gregory, one half of globe-conquering pop duo Goldfrapp, who, along with the eponymous Alison Goldfrapp, makes sounds ranging from the haunting soundscapes of debut album Felt Mountain to juggernaut pop hits such as the one you've heard, Ooh La La. The pulsing rhythms and squelchy disco textures found on records such as that one are provided by Will's love of analogue synthesizers, the most famous of which being the Moog, or Moog, first invented by American electronic music pioneer Bob Moog in 1961.
Will likes the instrument so much that he's created his own orchestra of them, the Will Gregory Moog Ensemble, who interpret both old and new pieces, and who will be hitting the stage of London's Barbican on the 8th of July as part of the Moog Concordant series of shows celebrating the life of Bob Moog, who died 10 years ago. Rob spoke a little bit earlier with Will, and this is what they spoke about.
Will, thanks so much for joining us. Now, the Moog Concordance. This sounds fantastic. It sounds like an early 20th century European peace deal. talk us through the name, perhaps, to begin with.
It's not my brainchild. This is Paul Smith, who's working with the Barbican, who set this whole week up. And he's been amazing because he's been in touch with the Moog family and the Moog factory, and they've sent over an amazing new System 55, which is a huge modular synth, very like the one that Keith Emerson would have used. And I think Keith Emerson is coming during the week to do a show, and there's various other people. Suicide are going to do something. So it's sort of deemed to be a celebration of 10 years since Robert Moog died, which doesn't seem very quite the right way to be saying it. So maybe the concordance is sort of covering that idea.
And the Moog Ensemble is your group, one of your groups. And it's, again, it's a fantastic sort of idea. Tell us about the genesis of getting synthesizer players all to pal up and play together. That's a pretty rare thing, isn't it?
Well, hopefully it is, yes. I think we're hopefully breaking ground here. And it was surprisingly easy. I mean, everyone is a musician that I've worked with. They're all friends, actually. Some people I've known, for a really long time. And it's amazing they've all agreed to do it. I was listening to Switched on Bach again a while ago and thought, wow, has anybody tried to do this in the flesh, as it were, in a live context with actually all the parts being played together rather than multi-tracked in a studio. And I thought, ooh, who could do it? And everybody that I thought of at that time is actually doing it, which is fantastic. And all of us are sort of enthusiastic and have a sort of love of synths. And some people are borrowing some of mine. I've got far too many. And other people have splashed out and, got themselves something. And other people obviously already had their own collection. So it's a real mixture of people, but everyone is amazing musician. And to some people, the synthesizer is slightly novel and out of their comfort zone, but they are sort of responding to treatment, as it were.
And we should fill our listeners in on the basics of this. The Moog is sort of the iconic, the very early synthesizer that makes these kind of warm, organic sounds that maybe people have got out of the way of listening to, or maybe it's the sound that a certain generation of people associate with that idea of synthesizers. What does Moog do for you, Will Gregory, that other synthesizers do not?
Well, it's just in a really amazing period in history of synthesizer design. They're basically, it's right at the beginning. The Mini Moog came out. It was virtually the first synthesizer to be made. In England, there was something called a VCS3, which is also a wonderful synth, but it's not designed for musician. It's not musician friendly. Whereas the Mini was immediately taken up by musicians because it was designed very much to be easily hands on. Everything was very logically laid out. And yes, the sound is amazing. It still sounds unlike anything else. It still delivers this kind of punch, particularly in the low end, that nothing else seems to be able to do. And I have to say, there's not just Moogs that were coming out at that time. In Japan, there were a lot of wonderful innovations being made. Roland, Korg, and Yamaha were sort of racing against each other and maybe the rest of the world to bring out new and fantastic sounding instruments. And at the distance of time, 40, 50 years later, some of them really still sound amazing. And we use them in the group So it's, yeah, now we say Moog as a kind of generic term in the same way we say Hoover to mean a vacuum cleaner. We say Moog to mean synthesizer. But it's not just obviously Moog that made these, a lot of these early beautiful instruments.
I mean, you spoke very eloquently in the past about synthesizers as being contemporary instruments, or about being, you know, in certain aspects, period instruments that are played in a contemporary way. You said that, you know, that they're similar to a violin in that instance. How do you stop the music that is played on Moogs from being retro, from being sort of 70s kind of prog rock, looking back kind of stuff? Because I know that you definitely see a bright future for the Moog and want to bring it on, don't you?
Yes, I think it has got its, you know, one foot in the past in our minds because of all the amazing things that people did with them. But they do very much, you know, need you to wear a cape, a lot of them, to bring it off.
No harm in that.
But maybe, you know, that's something for someone else to look into. I think that, you know, the thing was that they were very basic electronically. So the sounds that you're hearing are very undoctored and very pure, I think. And, you know, you're hearing the oscillators are just electrons rushing about, particularly in Bob Mood circuits. They're very elegant and very simple. And I think to begin with, we were rather shocked at the idea of listening to such sort of raw electronic sounds. But I think over the years, we've become accustomed to that and have grown to love it and the character that they have. Whereas at the time, I think we were on a journey, certainly with the manufacturers, to produce ever more complex sounds, sounds that sounded more like acoustic instruments, sounds that were more polyphonic so that you could play them like a piano. And I think that actually that direction has turned out to be a little bit of a cul-de-sac, and the initial direction of just having a monophonic instrument, an instrument just plays one note at a time, so you play that, say, with your right hand on the keyboard, and with your left hand you're squirreling around with all these knobs that you're given to, you know, to manipulate the sound with, that it turns out, I think, was the real vision. Because yes, especially if you plug, say, a foot pedal into it as well, you've got two ways of manipulating the sound as you play it. And you're starting to get into the territory of, you know, like a violin, and the degree to which you can be expressive and immediately colour the sound. And I think that these early instruments, they had that. And I think that's something that possibly we've slightly forgotten. And I'm sort of trying to say, look, you know, you could do all this. You can actually play as expressively as you could with an acoustic instrument, but don't be put off by the sound. It's just its own particular character, and I think it feels right now, the time is right to sort of press on and see where we can take that whole idea, you know, now that we've kind of got past the whole thing of trying to emulate acoustic instruments, which I think was the point where it became a bit of a dead end.
Yeah, well, we're gonna play a little clip, Will. If you stay on the line, we shall hear some Moog magic, and then we'll be back right after this. Wow. And of course, we got a few people into the studio to applaud the end of that. That was a movement of the Brandenburg Concerto. That was you.
Yeah, that sounded like us.
Didn't that sound great?
Over the top wobble at the end there. That definitely was us, yes.
Yeah, that's quite a finale. It's that kind of music. I'm reminded of the soundtrack to A Clockwork Orange as well, which was Beethoven played brilliantly on, presumably this was a Moog as well back in the day. It's that stuff. And you mentioned Switched on Bach, which was the sort of record that launched it all, I guess.
Yes, well, that's right. And of course, Wendy Carlos worked on Clockwork Orange. That's probably her version that you're talking about of the Beethoven. Mm. Yeah, no, that all of us in the group kind of remember that record as being quite a significant point in our early lives. And certainly we pay tribute to that idea by playing Bach. But obviously we also play new music, and we have composers in the group as well as myself who are interested in using the ensemble to, you know, or using the ensemble to sort of create new music that nothing else will sort of represent it in that way. And I think that's part of the manifesto of what we're doing, is to show how these instruments can work into the future, but also enjoy some of the things that happened in the past. And in fact, on the 8th, next Wednesday, we'll be doing a little excerpt of Anthony Burgess reading from Clockwork Orange with accompaniment, you know, with some of those. I think we will do a bit of the Beethoven behind it. So we're definitely lined up with you there.
Fantastic. It's sending a shiver up my spine at the very thought of it. It sounds absolutely magical. And just finally, Will, I wanted to talk about this idea of, you mentioned that sort of synthesizers sort of hit a bit of a brick wall when they simply tried to perfect the rendering the sound of an acoustic instrument, rather than reveling in the foreignness and, you know, perhaps futurism of the sound that they had. Is that very much sort of part of your manifesto as well, and part of the work that you've done with Goldfrapp as well? Is very much kind of bringing these really alien sounds into a sort of, you know, into a pop landscape.
Yeah, I think that they, you know, the thing is, what turned out to be the most important thing about these instruments is the ability for the musician to express themselves and manipulate the sound and get across their musical ideas. And I think in a way the sound is secondary to that, although of course if it sounds difficult to listen to, that is an issue. but I think that, as I say, I think we've warmed up to the idea and the sound world that the electronic instruments have. And also certainly with Goldfrapp, we've played with the idea that they can't ever be quite like a human voice, or, you know, they have some sort of limitation factor in that it's something slightly melancholy and emotional about them attempting to sound human and failing in a slightly sort of like, you know, badly designed robot orchestra or something. So it also has that element to it as well, which is sort of novel and, yes, has a kind of little emotional overtone.
Yes, it's like the warm heart of the robot, isn't it? The warm beating heart of the robot.
That's right, and I'm interested to know that people are now starting to call robots synths. So I'm not quite sure where that came from, but yes.
It's come full circle. It's not deeply confusing. It's actually a beautiful sound. Will Gregory of the Will Gregory Moog Ensemble will be playing the Moog Concordance at the Barbican. Check out that bit with the Anthony Burgess reading as well. Sounds absolutely fantastic. Will, thank you so much for your time. It's fantastic talking to you.
No worries.
That's all for edition 313 of the Monocle Weekly, Andrew. I enjoyed that programme.
You've got a bit of a quattro formaggi stuck in the corner of your mouth.
Oh, my God. Is that a full caper I see poking out? I like to call Bruno Di Fabio.
I do as well.
Do you think he's made that name up?
I don't know. It's a good name. It's a good name.
Bruno Di Fabio. It's good, isn't it?
Bruno de Glorious. Yeah, it's good.
I thought he was excellent value. He made a delicious pizza, and we wish him every will in the world, goodwill in the world, good wind in the world behind his sails, whatever it is. But people who can speak the English language fluently would say in that situation.
I don't think you boast about having a wind behind your pizza, but anyway. Good. I don't think that's going to be the catchphrase at the restaurant.
It sounds like something put into Google Translate. And we wish you a healthy wind behind your pizza. It was a great pleasure speaking to Will Gregory, albeit on the telephone. I think he's in the studio rehearsing his Moog Ensemble kind of amazing synthesizer orchestra. He's one of my heroes. Goldfrapp are an amazing band. Yeah. I know you love them too. So he's super cool. And wasn't Dana great on art? She was a nice lady, wasn't she?
Just how good when people can talk about stuff in a really kind of passionate way that kind of gets you excited about their world. I loved her.
I thought she was an amusing character. I think we should, next time she comes in, we should have a glass of wine.
And a bit of pizza as well.
And a bit of pizza. I like doing the food thing again. I like sort of taking it out into the kitchen and doing that sort of thing.
We should organise pudding maybe next week.
That was my sixth pizza in 5 days, though. Bruno had to make something pretty decent, otherwise I've literally thrown it in his face. Shall we thank the people behind the glass? Today's show is produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. And the Monocle Week will be back same time, same place. Probably the same person. Now, time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.